all of you know each other or no? Does somebody know everybody? You know everybody. Some of them are persons that you...
Yeah, I invited them from
the... And they're from their place at work or...
Yeah,
you know,
some of them are
lab mates.
Some of them attend like baby society meetings on Thursday.
Okay.
He is a friend of Shweta.
Yay! One of the remaining, because many of them went back to Beijing, right? Four or five of the students went back to Beijing. Last year. She left, they left.
Oh, yeah.
They came, they completed their studies and went back. Mm-hmm. Yeah? As far as I recall, yes?
Some of them are still around.
Sure, but some of them went back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Three of them are four.
Okay, so... Those of you that... Those of them, they're just your lab mates. They're like, this is a new experience, right? No experience?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Well, what I thought... to do was something that's in relation to what we're going to be doing tomorrow, kind of like a warm-up or like maybe an inside picture of what we're going to do tomorrow or the message of tomorrow. Because kind of one thing led to the next. A topic that I had been thinking of speaking about at colleges because I've done this with devotee audiences, and that's the importance of compassion, having compassion, and how to communicate that with a college audience, discuss it and involve them in a discussion is something that I've been thinking about, and so that kind of surfaced. And then the devotee that leads the program at MIT really wanted that topic, and in the course of developing that topic came here at Penn State, and Gunga Ryan came up with the idea that, hey, let's do a make this presentation and put on the backside of it a fundraising dinner for food relief for Japan, or not food relief, relief for Japan. Like, you know, put our words in action. Great. So we're going to do that. And although the wall space is prime, everybody likes the wall space. So you can stay there, it's quite okay. It's a very special space. Okay. So I'm going to explain things in a different way. Like, you know, maybe a 201 course on the same thing as a 101 course tomorrow night. And focus on two verses from Bhagavad Gita. And those two verses in Bhagavad Gita are chapter 2, text 41. And that verse is, try to keep it simple in language, Vyavasayatmika Buddhi. That phrase comes twice in Bhagavad Gita. Buddhi means spiritual intelligence, because there are other words that mean intelligence. Specifically, buddhi means spiritual intelligence, and spiritual intelligence means how to go to God. Yena mamupiyanti te. In the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, he gives, Dadami buddhi yogam tam. Unto those who are constantly devoted to me and worship me with faith, I give them the spiritual intelligence how to come to me. So we're all on a journey going somewhere. And for some people, it's just a journey. Like, ask them where they're going. And when I was a kid, there was a nursery rhyme that we learned. It still sticks. Row, row, row your boat. You know that one? Gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 merrily. Life is but a dream. Hey, it doesn't matter. Where are you going? It doesn't matter. Just rowing my boat. Where's your journey? I'm just journeying. Where are you going? Just journeying. Life is a journey. Okay. Hope you get there. And in this Bhagavad Gita verse, chapter 2, text 41, and also in the 10th chapter, it's very specific. The journey is reaching that place where there's no more birth and death. There's a Sanskrit term, samsara, means the wheel of birth and death. And the living entity is rotating through different forms of life according to their past activity, according to the modes of nature that they're associating with, guna and karma. They're moving from one condition to another condition to another condition, birth after birth after birth, and it's endless. Endless. Literally endless. Unless, in the human form of life, specifically the Vedic literature describes, there's an opportunity to get off the Ferris wheel. I mean, riding the Ferris wheel for a while is all right, but after some time you want to get off and do something else. But there's no getting off once you're strapped into that birth and death cycle. And the greatest act of compassion, because that's the topic for tomorrow evening, the title is Exercising Compassion in Contemporary Life. So the disaster in Japan is not the only disaster in the world. I know lots of people that are facing crisis in their life, and it's not at all easy for them, and it's not at all pleasant to see them go through that. And, you know, we're citizens of this Earth planet, and so there's a really big one in Japan, but they're all over the world. Libya and so on and so on. And, you know, when the New York Times published an article chronicling where huge numbers of persons were wiped out by some calamity. And one of the biggest ones was the potato famine in Ireland. I never knew that before. And Monsanto gets some of the credit for that, because at least, you know, I don't want to get too far afield, but when there are diverse species, then if one has a problem, the others will survive. There used to be, there were so many varieties of potatoes and so many varieties of apples and so many varieties of corn and so many varieties of, but, you know, Monsanto, whatever you called them, registered them, copyrighted them, trademarked them, whatever you call that thing. So, like, they only can sell it. So they just decided the ones they were going to sell. So it went from, like, 50 different potatoes to one potato. And there was a blight on that potato, and millions, whatever the number was, some large number of people. Anyway. Created by somebody that had material intelligence, but didn't necessarily have some foresight to see the problems that they were potentially creating with their material intelligence. It's a it's part of the going back as far as they kept records of when there were big, big disasters, the plague, going back to the Renaissance times, and so many things, earthquakes and volcanic eruptions and stuff, cyclones, hurricanes, destroying large numbers of, they just have statistics on human population, what to speak of other populations. So it's not a new thing. Dukkhalayam ashashvatam, in the language of Bhagavad Gita, this creation is a place of dukkha, a place of distress. And the real compassion is not just to relieve the person of some temporary distress, but let them stay in the situation where more distress is coming. The best is relieve them from that situation where more distress is coming, or relief from the cycle of samsara, or releasing the soul from being captured in material existence. That's the best form of compassion. So that's letting you know ahead of time. That's where I'm headed with it, the topic tomorrow. But it's going to be a lot of preliminary stuff to get to the topic tomorrow. And with this assembly of persons, I can go right to the topic. That's the topic. Best compassion is like the in the abstract that Varsana created, I think. You wrote that one? It is said that if you teach a man to fish, then you solve his hunger problem. You've heard that one before. If you eat fish. Teach a person to grow their own food, and then you solve their hunger problem rather than just feeding them. If by education of how to address the root of the problem, you've taken care of the problem rather than just one time, you know, a feel-good experience for the other person. So the root of the problem from a spiritual perspective is that we're in an atmosphere that isn't suited for us. We're in a material atmosphere and we're spiritual entities. So no matter what you do in this material atmosphere, the soul is going to feel some inconvenience. More than feel some inconvenience, we'll have to undergo tribulation. Dukkhalayam ashashvatam. It's just the nature of the place. So in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, I'm going to read the verse and a little bit of the purport, 241, so you can look it up later if you like. The first message that Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita is the distinction between the soul and matter. The Sanskrit term is Sankhya. Sankhya literally means to count. And if the divisions of matter are identified and separate from the divisions of matter is the soul, and distinguishing, you know, what the real identity. I'll go back. Arjun has a dilemma, like so many people have a dilemma. He doesn't know what his duty is. And he asks Krishna, please help me. Please instruct me, what is my duty? I'm going to paraphrase and say that Krishna says, before we speak about what your duty is, let's speak about who you are. And then we can speak about what your duty is. Novel. Who are you? And he identifies the self as spirit soul, distinct from the body. So, after describing the soul distinct from matter, then Krishna says, now I'm going to describe buddhi yoga, where you apply that knowledge in a practical way in your everyday life. Because it's one thing to have a concept of something spiritual, and it's another thing to live by it. We all have that experience. So Krishna is before he explains the details of Bodhi Yoga, he makes a distinction between one who's following the path of Bodhi and one who isn't. And the governing principle is, in all the things that they do, there's diversity in what they do, variety, unlimited to what they do, but there's one focus, and that's attaining the Supreme within whatever they do, and that means in their relationships with others, their acts of compassion unto others is to help others come to the position of realizing the same, their relationship with the Supreme. Whether you're a doctor, lawyer, teacher, whatever, you have relationships with persons, and in those relationships, see to the soul's connection with the Supreme. And in your own life, see to that, be conscious of that relationship with the Supreme. In two places in the purport, Prabhupada says, the highest perfection of this is to go beyond the bodily conception of life, or to relinquish the material conception of life. Which, for those that are familiar with Bhagavad Gita and Krishna's teachings, that's like, that's 1 + 1 = 2. That's our ABC. It's really fundamental. It's the first building block of going anywhere spiritually, is to understand that that concept. It's something like if you have a really long mathematical calculation and you make an error right at the beginning. All of your other calculations may be perfectly right, but you're going to have the wrong answer. And proportionally, each of the steps is going to be off based upon that initial mistake that you made. You can't just adjust things along the way. You have to go back to the beginning and correct the first mistake, and then you can get the right answer with all those other nice calculations you made afterwards. Similarly, the fundamental misconception of the self is to the self to identify with what it's not, instead of the self identifying with what it is. And then staying fixed in that consciousness means directing all activities in that spiritual direction. That's buddhi, spiritual intelligence, moving the soul in the direction of the natural atmosphere for the soul. And we can work in this world in that consciousness, even in the material atmosphere. And that's the art, that's the message of Bhagavad Gita. It's the art of work, the art of living. He says it a second time in the purport that everything, all of this very nice spiritual goal notion is dependent upon one being free from the bodily conception, not just theoretically, but so completely that one cannot act on the material platform or the bodily platform or the illusory conception. Just can't. So I'll just kind of put that on hold for a moment and share this with you. About a month ago, I was in Mayapur, in India. Mayapur is in West Bengal, and it's the place where Lord Chaitanya appeared. Lord Chaitanya is the personality who, you could say, popularized or inaugurated the public chanting of the holy name. It's a long description, but so I was there in Mayapur for almost 20 days, and one of the persons that I saw was somebody who was my same age, who like 1 month apart from me, had joined the Boston Temple, because I went from pre-med school, took a leave of absence, moved into the ashram at the Boston Temple, and never left. And that was the summer of 1970. And 1 month after I started living in the ashram at the Boston Temple, another devotee and his wife, young American couple, moved into the temple also. And I saw him for the first time in like many, 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 many years. I immediately recognized him, and he was surprised that I recognized him. Did you recognize me? He said, yeah. The devotee, some of you may know him by name. His wife is Narayani, and my goodness, his name is escaping me at this moment. He, Purna Pragya, he's very brahminical, very scholarly. He's rewritten the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita in a succinct form, the whole Mahabharata in a succinct form, Srimad Bhagavatam in a succinct form, like, you know, easily accessible. He's not like cerebral, he's just like an intellectual. He's down-to-earth intellectual. He's just like, and he's a very warm, affable person. So I asked him, how's it going? And he said, I'm looking for an engagement right now. I just finished all the writing that I did, and I'm looking for some service. So I said, well, what's your idea? What would you like to do? And he lit up like, you know, a light bulb. He said, here's what I'd like to do. He was just in Singapore, but the Singapore government doesn't allow foreigners to do much of anything. Like, it's really strict. They don't want foreign influence to do anything, especially religious something, so he wasn't able to do it effectively there. He said, I'd like to be with a group of students, preferably university students, but new students, persons whose minds are open, and start with, like, you know, a whole series of discussions on you're not this body, like what I'm doing right now, in a very, but you know, all he does is he writes. You know, he's thinking how to educate people. That's all he does. He's been doing it for 30 years. He's really good at it too. So, you know, since we're spirit soul, but we think that we're something else, what problems does that take us into? What's the complication with that mistake? And then, in contrast, what's the concept of soul? What's the big deal? So you think that you're spirit soul and you try to act that way. Where does that take you? And then slowly, slowly, over a series of, like, taking this topic and real down to earth, real practical, you know, what about your academics? What about your home life? What about your eating? What about your, you know, the stuff that you do? And if you have a bodily conception, if you have a spiritual conception, how will that shape your life in a different way? And he said, I'd really like to do that. I was thinking, wow. I told him, I'd really like you to do that. I bet there's a opportunity. When I come back to America, I'm going to explore some options, and maybe we can create a forum for you to have such seminars. So he gave me his email address, and I'm sharing this with you for a reason. It's there are many things that are grabbing our attention, and, you know, the calamity in Japan, the earthquake, and the nuclear reactor, and suffering. When suffering goes on in a mass scale, a very large scale, it grabs everyone's attention, and then people are also thinking, they have to protect their own backside. The Department of Energy is thinking, you know, we better check our nuclear reactors and make sure we have our system safe, and on and on and on. But making it doesn't solve the problem. If the soul is still in an atmosphere that's not suited for it, in a material atmosphere, which sounds like too fundamental, like, you know, but it's not too fundamental. It's the problem. And there's a way to resolve the problem. But it takes a thoughtful person, takes some education, takes some, a little purification to consider what the options are. So there's one other verse in Bhagavad Gita in the 13th chapter. It's also a Sankhya section. A Sankhya is where matter and spirit are being differentiated. And in that verse, it's 13:22, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is speaking about why the living entity is in the material condition and why there's misfortune. For the living entity that doesn't want misfortune. Everyone wants happiness and good fortune, but misfortune comes. And why does it come? So the verse is describing. I'll just... the living entity in material nature follows the ways of life, enjoying the three modes of material nature. This is due to his association with that nature, thus he meets with good and evil amongst various species. Sad asad yanma joni, janma jonishu. Sad asad means sat, means eternal, and asat means not eternal or temporary, or good and bad, or good fortune, ill fortune. We create our own good fortune or ill fortune based upon the choices that we make, how we associate with material nature, how we address ourselves to the situations that life sends our way. We make choices. And based upon those choices, we implicate ourselves in the laws of nature. We create our own good fortune, ill fortune. And when there isn't spiritual education or spiritual training, then the choices are one variety of material options or another variety of material options without having a clear spiritual option. So, good fortune, ill fortune, they're all unfortunate. It's bondage to the cycle of birth and death. In the purport, Prabhupada explains like this, the soul is neutral. But if the soul, due to past free will choices, gets the body of a king, and he sits on a throne, and he enjoys regal life. But his next life or some other life, he may be in a dog's body. Due to his free will choices, he deserves that life form, and so he behaves like a dog. He barks, and he wags his tail and chews on bones because he's got a dog's body. And then that soul becomes a tree, and he stands there for so many hundreds of years, etc. Or, and on and on. We're in this human form of life, not in the dog's body or a tree's body, but previously and subsequently, we may not be in a human life form. And while in the human life form, good question to ask is, what's the purpose? This is a machine. What's the purpose of the machine? It's been awarded by material nature. What's the design of this machine? What's it meant for? It's like, you know, you can take an iPod and crack nutshells with it. But that's not what it's designed for. It's designed for many other things. And maybe you can crack some nutshells with it, but it can damage the machine. And if you know how to operate an iPod, you can, or whatever the other devices that are created, machines, then you can do so many things. So what's this one? what's the operator's manual say for this one? Because it was produced by material nature. And the message of Bhagavad Gita is that the design of the human form of life is self-realization, or extricating the soul from the material situation altogether, relieving the soul from the bondage of material existence. So you don't have to get the body of a dog, or the body of a tree, or body of a king, or a body of an elephant, or a body of a human, or a body of a whatever it is, and go through the whole cycle of thinking that's who I am, when in fact that's not who we are. It's going back to the the question that Arjuna was asking Krishna: what's my duty? He had a very difficult, extremely difficult circumstances. I mean, more difficult than most of us will ever experience. He had a situation where, as a great Kshatriya warrior, he had to fight against his relatives, and fight against his teacher, and fight against his grandfather, who raised him in the absence of his father. His venerable grandfather. And he didn't want to do it. But he didn't know really what the right thing to do was, so he asked Krishna what the right thing to do was. And Krishna's reply was, let's first talk about who you are, before we talk about what you should be doing. What we should be doing is this buddhi yoga, working in such a way that our intelligence that guides us is an intelligence that's given by God, because that's what the later verse is describing. He's situated within the heart, and he's giving messages outside also. And if we so desire, he'll give us the intelligence how to end this entanglement of delusion and accepting what's not for what is, and accepting what isn't for what is. Anyway, getting it all backwards. And when we get it backwards, then there's suffering. It's just the nature of the place that we're in. And it's not our natural position. So, what to do? The whole teaching of Bhagavad Gita is step by step taking Arjuna, which means taking the audience, us, the reader, of the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, from the state of delusion, gradually to understand the nature of the soul, gradually to see how to work in that consciousness, in the spirit of detachment, doing our duties very, very conscientiously, but maintaining this higher spiritual aspiration all the time, and further awakening that consciousness up to the stage of full divine consciousness or God consciousness. That's the lesson or the message of Bhagavad Gita. The chanting that we were doing at the very beginning is specifically, it's a process. Mantra is a Sanskrit term. Man means mind, and tra means to deliver or release the mind from material conceptions and allow it to receive spiritual conceptions. And that spiritual conception is right within the sound vibration of the mantra. It's sounds or divine sounds, it's names of God. Just for those of you that are new, the song that I sang, Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari, it's a song that's describing the spiritual world. And in this, when I was growing up, little boy, in a Christian family, I remember very clearly asking my parents, I'm going to Sunday school, we hear about the kingdom of God, could you tell me what it's like there? have an answer. They just said, oh, that's a very nice question. And you know how it is with little kids. They embarrass me. They said, you know, go ahead, tell our friends. They just came to visit. Tell them what you said. Come on. Like, you know, a wind-up doll. And so the wind-up doll is supposed to, like, I want to know what the kingdom of God is like. Isn't that cute? So I stopped asking. The priest didn't know, and, you know, nobody knew. You know, you're supposed to go to the kingdom of God, but what's it like there? Nobody knows. Well, it's nice. Well, tell me a little bit more than it's nice. What's it like? Don't know. But they wouldn't say they don't know. But they don't know. So that the song is describing the kingdom of God. It's Radha Madhava. Madhava is the name of God, and one of Krishna's names, and Kunja. Kunja means groves. Like, this is a nice painting of Radha and Krishna in a grove of trees. And Bihari means he's enjoying with the cows and the peacocks and the parrots and the river Jamuna and the deer and the cowherd boys and, you know, the residents of Vrindavan. He's enjoying the atmosphere of Vrindavan. Kunja Bihari. Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. And Yasoda Nandana. He's the Nandana means the son. He's the son of Mother Yasoda. Now, God's not the son of anybody. He's the father of everybody. He's the source of everything. But in his loving dealings, some of his very confidential devotees, they like not just to serve him, but they like to be his friend. They like to take care of him as if he's dependent. So that's Mother Yasoda. She has that affection, so Krishna takes the role, the position, as the dependent. And he wants Mother Yasoda to feed him, and if she doesn't feed him, he throws a tantrum. And, right? Children do that sometimes. Well, so, anyway, like this nice painting back there in the corner, Krishna's looking at you, he's eating butter because he went to the storeroom of Mother Yasoda and broke into the milk and yogurt. Oh, okay, well, over there also, Makanchur, Krishna's eating butter out of a butter pot. And here's Mother Yasoda tying Krishna because he was very naughty. He broke into the storeroom and broke all the butter pots and fed the butter to all the monkeys. And so she came and shook her finger at him. He was crying, Mother Yasoda. So she bound him with a rope so she could carry on with her duties. And anyway, so first she couldn't bind him, so she got more rope and tried to bind him, tied the ropes together, and still was too short. She got a whole bunch of rope, tied it. You know, mathematically it should work, but it just wouldn't go around his belly. And then she was becoming very distressed. Oh, there's Mother Yasoda also, that nice painting. So Yasoda Nandana. It's describing Krishna and his loving dealings in the spiritual world. So the songs, or the invoking of the sound vibration, is to bring our consciousness to the Supreme. And one of the teachings found in the scripture is that the names of God are none different than Him. It's not true for something material. For something material, if I was thirsty and just said, water, 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 the sound vibration and the object are different. My throat will become more dry just by calling water, water. there's some other way to get water. But spiritually, the sound and the object are non-different. Abhinatvam nama namino in Sanskrit. Abhina means there's no difference between the name and the object named. Object and subject are the same. So when we're calling Krishna's name, in that sound vibration, Krishna is present. Or Yasoda Nandana, the darling beloved of Mother Yasoda, that sound vibration, he's present. Kunja Bihari, he's present. Radha Madhava, they're present. But because the sound is absolute, of for those things absolute, God is absolute, the sound and the named object are non-different. So gradually, ever so gradually, by the process of hearing spiritual sounds, including the messages of Bhagavad Gita and these mantras, hearing spiritual sounds, the dormant consciousness of the soul awakens. And as the dormant consciousness of the soul awakens, the misconceptions of who we thought we were, this body or this mind, gradually diminish. And so the conception that I'm American and you're Indian and you're Chinese, it disappears because that's not a real identity. A real identity is I'm spirit soul and you're spirit soul. We have these machines, this body, and this one happened to appear over here, and that one happened to appear over there, and that one happened to appear over there, and but that's not who we are. The deeper sense is we have a spiritual identity. We can work with the fact that I've been given a man's body and someone else is given a woman's body, and you know, we act appropriately and responsibly in those roles. But that's not our identity. Someone's older, so you respect the someone that's older, but it's not their identity. Someone's a little baby and you care for the little baby because they're dependent and so forth, but that's not their identity. Ultimately, the body is changing and the body is given up and another body is taken, and the soul is the real vital force and is meant to be realized, and by the Vedic conception, released from the cycle of birth and death. So that's even better than teaching somebody to fish so they can have food, or to grow their own food so they can take care of their hunger problem. If you release the soul from material existence, there's no more hunger. There's no more pain. There's no more anxiety. It's Vaikuntha. And that's what the spiritual realm is called, Vaikuntha. And the Vedic literature is replete, filled with descriptions of that spiritual realm. That is our natural position. A metaphor is sometimes given, a comparison. If you take a fish out of water, and you may give the fish so many amenities. Here's a nice television. Here's some lemonade. Nice straw. Here's some sunglasses, because it's really, you know, bright light. Here's a hammock you can, you know, swing in. But, you know, they're not happy unless they're in water. As soon as they're in water, they're happy. Because that's their natural atmosphere. Living facility, living arrangement. Likewise, the Vedic literature gives the information. The soul has its natural position, and we're in this unnatural position presently, trying to adjust it so that it's comfortable. But it's never going to be comfortable. It's not meant for us. So what to do? And then it's the problem, why and what to do, is it's not so much in the forefront of people's thinking in this present age. Vedic literature tells us in previous ages it was very prominent. But this present age, it's like winter. It's a very bleak season. The age of mankind, and the cycle is a long cycle. It's 432,000 years long. And it goes down and down like a vortex. Just so the good qualities are practically gone. And then the liberating figure comes and delivers souls, and the Satyuga begins again, where people are again very prominently engaged in spiritual realization. So I'm giving a very broad kind of depiction here, but the message that Bhagavad Gita wishes to deliver to people of this age is, here's the problem. We've lost a sense of who we really are, and we've lost the sense, in addition, how to live accordingly to our real spiritual identity in this material atmosphere. There is a way to very naturally live in this material atmosphere, even though we don't belong here. We act in consciousness in terms of the spiritual goal, and meanwhile we conduct our external activities in the quality of goodness, compassion being one of those qualities of goodness. So we attend to the needs of the temporal, but ultimately we're looking to the welfare of the soul. So that's like a little summary of what I'm going to be saying tomorrow in a simpler form, much simpler form. I asked one of the devotees, what should I speak about? And they said, well, a preliminary to what you're going to do tomorrow. So that's what I tried to do. Any discussion? Yes.
Maharaj, I don't know whether it just naturally happens with people, but when someone hears that, you know, you're not body or soul, one tends, like, if they see something happen at another person's place, like, you know, let's say another person's relatives passed away, for example.
Another person's what?
Relative.
Relative.
Yeah, their relatives passed away or something.
Okay.
So this person, he just learned this, you know, you're not his body or spirit, soul.
So don't worry, you said
yeah,
they're not their body.
Spirits, yeah, exactly. So my...
That's immaturity.
I have a question that I can understand that, you know, a more mature understanding is that, you know, that, yeah, the soul has passed away, but at the same time, there's this one other person behind, and you cannot be callous to that person's feelings, because...
Of course not.
So, I sometimes have a problem of, you know, putting both of these together, that, because when a person says that...
Here's a simple response to your question. Be sensitive to whatever that space is that they're in. And this is not just when somebody's passed away. It's anything. Anything. Tune in to, like, you know, go on the bridge over to where they are and meet them where they are. And be with them where they are, where their needs are, their concerns are, and just, like, hang out for a while. So when somebody has, in the case, that's a general, be careful that you don't, like, you know, lose your spiritual purpose in doing so. But when you extend to others, that's the platform. You meet them in their comfort zone, in their, what their needs are, their concerns are. Needs, interests, and concerns. You've heard those phrases. So you meet them there. And not necessarily you have to, like, solve those or supply resources for those things, but at least, you know, you understand, they know that you understand and you care. Often, with specific to death of a near one, they just need people to be with them. And to some degree, help them take care of practical things. Like there was a Bengali family. They were husband and wife were conducting a travel agency, Bharat Travels in Manhattan. And they were, you know, like doing lots of service for the devotees. Suddenly, the woman's husband died very unexpectedly. The devotees came and they took care of everything. She didn't have to cook a meal. She didn't have to like wash her clothes. She didn't have to like take care of her kids. Devotees took care of everything. And, you know, they didn't like say, you're not this body and he's not this body, don't worry about it. They just, you know, they were there to help her in that very distressful time. So I was out of the country when that happened, but when I met with her, those were the words that she spoke. The devotees were so kind, they just took care of everything. Now, she knew the message of Bhagavad Gita because she was a devotee. But that wasn't, you know, that wasn't what the devotees gave her. They gave her what she needed. Just like the opportunity to take care of the family matters. Someone helped her with that too, and you know, what's going to happen with the finances and how the kid's going to continue with their education and all of that. Then when she went to, you know, I'm sure, when she went to Bhagavad Gita class next time, or read Bhagavad Gita again, you know, her receiver was, you know, full volume. So that's, you know, I've been in these situations, and you know, similarly, families just need to be comforted. When they're ready to ask the question, I mean, when they're ready to hear the message, they'll ask the question. When they ask the question, even still, one has to be very careful, because feelings are raw and delicate. But, you know, when they're asking, they're ready to hear. Otherwise, it's mainly just need comfort and assistance, and, you know, know that people care. If you're with someone that is, you know, whose consciousness is on a more spiritually evolved position, then one can speak more directly. That's exceptional. It's not the rule. It's exceptional. Okay. Yes?
Maharaj, you were mentioning that Dukkhala and Ashashvatam, this place is a place of distress, and we see a lot of like things happening in Japan and stuff like that. My question is, like, why is it...
like that?
Designed to be like that. Why can't it be like designed where...
There's another place that is designed differently. And it's far more inviting. But, it lets a metaphor that's used, appropriate metaphor that is used, that a prison house is not a comfortable place by design. When a government forms, it's not like they start rubbing their hands together and say, I can't wait to make this prison house. But it's necessary to have a prison house because some persons are going to be disruptive or like create havoc or disharmonious within the state, and so they have a right to live, but they live in a restricted situation. And the restricted situation is to help them learn a lesson. It's not just a house. There's a house of detention, but it's also a house of correction, ideally. So the distress is to help us get a lesson. Like the free will choices that I've made, or this spirit of enjoying independently of the Supreme, it's not a good program. It could be if I chose differently. So the law-abiding citizen and the law-breaking citizen. there's two different living situations for them. There's a whole lot more freedom with the law-abiding citizen. But with, you know, it seems like a contradiction, because if I'm abiding by the law, then I'm accepting restrictions. So I'm restricted. But then I have more freedom. And I don't accept those restrictions of the government, then I have more, my freedom is restricted. And commensurate with or proportionate to the degree of my rebelliousness and wrong, you know, mistaken choices, there are degrees of distress. And then go the other way. There are degrees of material happiness for those who perform pious activities, activities of goodness. Then there's proportionate material enjoyments. And the world is made with these varieties. But there's another place, Krishna very clearly described another place, where it's not duality at all. And that's to be learned or inquired about and understood and aspired for. So by design, prison houses are houses of correction. It's not a threat, it's not a threat, it's not intimidation. It's just, here's the rules. Well, how come there have to be rules? There's rules. There's laws of nature. There's a place where there's no influence of material nature at all. If you wish, you can go there. But if you have this rebellious spirit, and then there's rules. And you violate the rules, and you lose some of your freedom. Not unreasonable. It's quite reasonable. Yes, you got something.
I have this mental image of two trains which are running parallel, like, so the one that's going forward, let's say that's the spiritual train.
Okay.
Where we do activities and we have the consciousness that's for the spiritual progress. And the other one goes, you know, the material
train.
So I find myself, you know, hopping on and off. I get on this train, I go for some time because my friends are there, and so I like to be with them, so I'm on the spiritual train. But then I get distracted, I hop off, I go into this thing, and then I try to remind myself that, you know, maybe I need to go back to the spiritual train. And then there's this callous attitude that, you know what, it's okay if the train is long enough that I can probably jump back on, you know, that the opportunity doesn't cease to, you know, exist. So I you know, the incorrigible hop on, hop off kind of thing I keep doing.
That's the dialogue. Now, what's the question?
The question is, like, how to just stick on one thing. And also the attitude, I guess, like that, you know, I still won't lose the opportunity of...
As far as opportunity goes, you're okay. Then you're okay because Krishna's nature is he's loving. And he never, like, you know, writes you off. Okay, you had too many chances, that's it. Forget it. It's not like that. Because his nature is loving. But, if... like any relationship, from our side, if we become insensitive to a person who we have some relationship with, our sensitivities wane, they diminish. You just like take another person for granted, and like, you know, you're with them, you're present with them, and then just kind of ignore them, and then present with them and kind of ignore them, and it damages the relationship. If somebody did that with you, it was like, huh? So, but you know, the problem is from our side, not from Krishna's side. We become callous, or we due to those inattentivenesses or negligences, our heart becomes hard instead of soft. So it makes it hard from our side to again connect in a very meaningful way. But, you know, the number of chances given by Krishna don't diminish. It's just that it becomes more, like, let's say, with chanting. If you're negligent in chanting for some period of time, just negligent in chanting, to get back into chanting, it's more difficult than even when you start, because there's this, you know, the heart has become hard. You know, the sensibilities have become dull. It's more difficult. So there should be some concern, and you know how to stay steady. But what you described is in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's language, unsteady devotion or anishtita bhakti. And don't worry, it's a stage, and unsteady devotion is predictable. On again, off again, unsteady. And it's the on again is circumstantial. Like, you know, you wake up, you realize that you had fallen asleep, so you wake up. Or you start to suffer, and you don't like to suffer, so I better pay attention. You know, the impetus becomes stronger. And then the suffering diminishes, and so then the effort diminishes. But then, you know, in course of time, you can recognize, wait a minute, just like you're describing, I don't want to have this unsteadiness thing. I want steadiness. So that's that desire for steadiness is like more than half of what's needed to attain steadiness. The desire to attain the kingdom of God, the desire to be in a relationship, a loving relationship with God or with another, is major part of having that loving relationship. So be clear about, is this what I really want? And that, you know, Krishna will also ask you, are you sure? What if you don't have any difficulties? Would that be all right? And that's really what you want? Then you have some period of time where there's no difficulties. But if you're, then some difficulties come, it's not a permanent arrangement to no difficulties. Anyway, different tests will come. Krishna may provide some sense gratification. Here's some sense gratification. Sure this? Sure you want me? How about that? So it takes some internal conviction, an internal purity, to be really clear, this is what I want. And when you're clear what you want, then things move from Krishna's side. You know, he clears the way obstacles and helps you become very firm in determination. Just like it's described in Bhagavad Gita, for those who worship in different ways, Krishna gives them the faith to worship in different ways. But for those who want him, Krishna gives that conviction also. So it's more a matter of, in your own heart, to be clear what you want. and that unsteady stage is some but not complete. Spiritual desire but not complete, not yet mature. Yeah, you can.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's nice. This is with respect to the metaphor. Like, you spoke about the fish when it's out, and you give it anything, and it knows that it likes, I mean, its constitutional position is in the water, and so it's happy. But if you give me, like, for example, an iPad and a smartphone and a car, I think I'm very, very happy. So, I mean, that's a very hard situation from which we can push off someone. So how do you, because I don't know at all what is my constitutional position, so how is it that we can...
Well, if you're honest with yourself, then you can say, ask, is this happiness? Is this happiness? What is the nature of happiness? What is it that I want? A thoughtful person will have the answer to those questions, and one that's not won't have the answer to those questions because they haven't asked. Another way of responding to your question is, statistics show that suicide is highest in the most affluent sections of society. And the reason is they had the expectation for happiness, and that was keeping them going to get things that would bring happiness. But when you got the things, it didn't bring the happiness. So it's like despair. It's the expectation of happiness that keeps us going. But can you grab it? It's where'd it go? It's elusive. It just disappeared. The happiness in one moment becomes unhappiness in the next moment. You saw the presentation that I made here some time ago about spiritual economics. And, you know, there's all kinds of studies about the expectations for happiness from consumer economics. And those people that have more report they're less happy than those people that have less report they're more happy. And there's all kinds of, like, you know, scholarly ways of giving it nomenclature and analyzing the thing. The underlying principle is one. Professor Enderline, very humbly named it after himself, from the University of Princeton, studying, you know, the happiness, the expectation for happiness for the affluent section of society. And they're less happy. So things don't bring happiness. But, you know, people know this. People that are experienced at this. Remember hearing Radhanath Maharaj describing his father, who was, you know, a nice Jewish man who had his whole life was getting money. And he shared this with his son not so long ago, that when his sister was dying, he, you know, all the wealth that he had couldn't take care of doing anything for her. And his realization was, what happiness have I purchased through all this wealth, a whole life spent accumulating wealth? And it can't buy me happiness. I wasted my life. That's, you know, that's a rude and sorrowful feeling, that I wasted my whole life. But at least he got a realization that, you know, things don't bring happiness. That's not what happiness is. What is it? How do you get it? It's something that we know when we feel it, what it is. And there's happiness within the modes of nature, and then there's happiness of the soul. Bhagavad-gita's message is real happiness is within. When that real happiness is there, then I don't need something outside of myself. So tell that to the person that's got the car and the smartphone and the whatever it is, and say, you know, wait a while till the thing breaks, or, you know, you're gone, and that you know, what, how is that object going to bring you happiness? Anyway, such persons aren't being thoughtful. They can't be thoughtful because they're so absorbed. It's like a child playing a little Nintendo game or whatever. They're absorbed. Their mind is absorbed in that little distraction. Is that happiness? And somebody might say, well, if they think they're happy, then that's happiness. But in the next moment, they're crying for whatever the reason. Or like this example, you know, somebody near to them is gone. Somebody right next to them is now gone. Where is that happiness? From the Vedic perspective, that which is enduring is real, and that which is flickering is not real. Now you see it, now you don't. It's like a shadow, or the rabbit in the hat. Now you see it, now you don't. It's not, there's no substance there. Real happiness is enduring. Real happiness is ever increasing. That's real happiness. That's what we want. That's the happiness that we want. And this other is not, it's a shadow of the real thing. As a devotee, you can understand that. As someone that you're trying to explain, if their senses are not purified and their mind is not purified, their conceptions of life are not purified, they're not going to relate to it. Don't tell me, you know, my Nintendo game and my smartphone and my car are not. I'm happy. You know, leave me alone. Until something happens. Because some calamity comes or something. The car breaks or the car gets smashed or their family member dies in the accident or something. Something. Then the happiness is gone. And that's not happiness. There's sat and asat. Eternal and illusory, ephemeral. Okay. Yes?
I had a couple of questions. First question is that in our daily life, material life, like throughout our childhood, especially if we are not brought up in our devotional atmosphere, we have been given the training that we are this body, we are not this soul. I mean, the activities are centered around the placing the body or the senses. And even in the colleges, scientifically, also speaking, they teach the same thing. So this propaganda is going on that, oh, your ultimate aim of life is to just please the body, and that's it, like, this life is one. So how does one cultivate faith that, because spirituality is like completely shattering the root of the material conception of life, that we are not the body. So how does one cultivate faith in this?
By hearing. Faith is developed by hearing. I'll give a practical example. Medicine. Supposing you start to get a pain, or it's like something. You feel like yuck, or something. I know somebody that had abdominal pain and it was causing migraine headaches, and they were, you know, they're a stoic person, but they had to like deal with it. So what do? You try to find a good doctor. Well, how do you know who's a good doctor? Well, you ask different people, that somebody that's a specialist in, you know, gastrointestinal problems. You got a list of some people. So that's hearing. Then you go and visit them. I did this with Ayurvedic medicine. So I had my health collapsed some years ago. So I went to like four or five different Ayurvedic doctors. And I heard from them, and I got a sense of, you know, what I got a sense of their character. And I began taking the medicine of one of them because and following the diet. And by doing that, I could see improvement. So faith develops when you act in knowledge, right in Bhagavad Gita. So I hear something, I act on it, and I get this, if it's knowledge, something happens. When that something happens, you get a realization. You get a realization, your faith increases. So the initial faith that's required is very minimal. The initial faith is there is something beyond this facade, beyond the veneer of this place. There's something. I don't know what that something is, but I know there's something. Something that's more meaningful, more tangible, more satisfying. Something. I want to know, I want to reach that something. I want to experience that something. I want to live there with that something. So now I'm going to look around. And I hear. And based upon what I hear, if something makes sense, I'll apply it. If it's real knowledge, then something happens. Get a realization. Go back to that source. Like that. Based on hearing from the proper source. Faith grows.
Things don't give us happiness. So after hearing that, like, for example, I developed a false sense of renunciation, like, oh, I don't need these things. But nevertheless, in our daily life, we do need these things to some extent. So how do we understand the balance?
By practical experience, just like you described. This is another one of the unsteadinesses, the anishtata. In an immature stage, the first of the unsteadinesses is one feels what's the Sanskrit? Anyway, one feels a false sense of spiritual accomplishment. Prematurely, immaturely, artificially, I've mastered, like the example is given of a child who begins his studies and thinks, I know everything already. And they've just begun their studies. Oh, I know everything already. It's false. But that sense of accomplishment or attainment may be there in the beginning stage. Oh, I can. So I'm so advanced, I can just do without so many things. And then when they realize it's not, then you can go the other way. And, you know, vacillating and unsteady. So by experience, it's better to be, in real simple terms, better to make progress in little incremental steps and do that steadily. Do something and sustain it for some time. And then make a little increase and sustain that for some time. Make a little increase and sustain that for some time. That's best. If one can sustain something that's a little more than a little, modest, intermediate, that's fine. But sustain. So being realistic with what our spiritual capacity is. That's for you too. This, you know, with this two-train example. What's that sound? It's coming right through the floor? It's not coming through the our electronics or something. Okay, fine. Anything else? Our newer folks here have any thoughts you want to share? Questions? Taking it in. Okay. Yeah?
I want to just whatever you were saying. Some people say that definitely there are some things that we would have to use.
Yeah.
There is material we would have to use.
Sure. Sure.
But then using them and attaching with them
is
a different thing.
Very good, very good.
This is how to decide whether we are attaching with it or we are just using it.
Very simple. put it in broad terms, if a spiritual objective is there, then it can be using. If it's absent, then it's attachment. So, like, there's a higher principle. Even if it's higher principle, it's not just a value. Like, doing good for others is a value. If that's not connected to a spiritual concept of myself and others, then it can become an attachment. It's likely to be an attachment. An attachment even in the mode of goodness, but an attachment. And attachments bind one to birth and death. So, what's using something, Nirbandha Krishna Sambande Yuktam Vairagya Uchite, in Sanskrit, that's Rupa Goswami's teachings. I'm just trying to simplify it in real easy language. Seeing something in relation to Hari, who is the proprietor of all things, if I see something in relation to Hari and use it in his service, that's real detachment, real renunciation. And if I don't see that connection, and I'm trying to use something, there's a false sense of proprietorship. It's like, you know, it's mine. But in fact, it's not mine. And the proof it's not mine, it'll be taken from me. Ultimately, at death, whatever it is. So, if I don't have the sense of who the actual proprietor is and use in relation to the actual proprietor, to one degree or another, there's attachment. Even if it's I'm just using something. Well, you know, I have to eat. To survive, you have to eat. If you try to not eat, you won't survive. So how do you connect that eating process to just using something that's practical? Connect it to a spiritual purpose, to God and God's service. And we need to sleep, so and so on.
But sometimes mind starts in such a way that it would say, okay, that is a spiritual power, and it would start fooling itself.
Sure, sure. Therefore we need real standards, not just the mind. The mind is not the judge. The standard is the scripture. That's the that's the place where you know something, whether it falls on this side or that side, is to be understood. Or Guru Sadhu Shastra. You know those terms. That's the deciding factor. So if I have something in my mind that says, I just hold that up to the light of Guru Sadhu Shastra, then it can tell it whether it was right or not. Therefore, it's good to have some understanding of what these messages of Bhagavad Gita are, so I can hold up to that light. And then other persons who are very accomplished in this, and I can approach them, say, what about this? And they can say, yeah, it's good, or you need to adjust that a little bit. Sadhu. Okay. Looks like we'll have a little kirtan and then prasadam. I'll Kirtan first. I brought with me some deity Mahaprasadam from the New York temple. It's like right from this morning's offering. Oh, after Kirtan, I'll distribute it.